Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super happy to be talking with Dr. Peter Levine. Firstly, Peter, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Oh, sure. Gladly. Looking forward.
Many people here will be familiar with your work in somatic experiencing. We will talk about that, but in this interview, I'm also keen to get a little more into how people can work with some of those principles with themselves. I know a lot of people on their healing journeys are struggling with the lack of external support, and that obviously can be very important, but the more we can learn to transform our own inner landscape often is important. Just to give people that aren't aware a bit of Peter's background, Peter Levine, PhD, is the creator of somatic experiencing, a clinical method to resolve trauma symptoms. He received his PhD in medical biophysics from the University of California in Berkeley and holds a doctorate in psychology from International University. He has worked in the field of stress and trauma for over 40 years. Peter received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the United States Association for Body Psychotherapy in 2010. And he's the author of best-selling books, including Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Releases Trauma and Restores Goodness, and Trauma and Memory, Brain and Body in a Search for the Living Past. So, Peter, just to give a little bit of context for those that might be newer to your work, maybe you could just say briefly what the somatic experiencing approach is and why it's so important in trauma healing.
Okay. When I started to develop the work, I actually wasn't calling it somatic experience at the time. That was in the late 1960s into the mid-1970s. And there wasn't yet the definition, there wouldn't be for another decade, of the definition of trauma as PTSD, where it was seen as a brain disorder, brain disease even, that one could at best manage it with medication and try to change one's negative thoughts. And so I guess you could say, fortunately, I wasn't aware of that. or it might have stopped me in developing somatic experiencing. When something happens and we're overwhelmed, we're frightened, or we recoil for something, like you just go outside your house and you see somebody being hit by a car and you go, ah, and that's something the body does. When we're traumatized, our body, our jaws clench, our guts tighten, our breathing becomes shallow, or we hyperventilate. And these are all things that the body does. And that's where trauma really plays out in the theater of the body. And so if we understand that, and then we can learn to have new experiences in the body that in a way contradict those of the overwhelming helplessness. If we're able to stand back and observe the sensations that are going on in our bodies, the places where we get stuck, which is where trauma is, we're able to move through and to come back into ourselves and to feel our own vitality, our own energy, being able to be in the here and now. I suppose in a way you could say trauma is a disorder of not being able to be in the here and now. So that's really, really the key, is a way of helping to take people from stuckness, from trauma, into flow, into more flow, and then into being able to transform these experiences by allowing the body sensations to move through.
Because one of the things that is, I think, for many people was revelatory in your work was the realization that trauma is held in the body, and it's held in a state of freeze or in a state of shutdown. And maybe you can say a little bit about that piece and the kind of how the unraveling of that can be so important.
Yes. You know, again, when I started developing the work, there was no understanding of the freeze or the what I call a collapse response, when we just fall into overwhelming helplessness. And at the time, the only thing people knew about was the fight or flight response, so-called fight or flight response. And I realized that this was a component in what happens to people, which we now call trauma. But there was another two that are even more important, or as important at least, in understanding trauma. And that is when our body, when we experience life threat, then our body just shuts down. We basically just tune down our whole energy level. We don't move. Now, of course, when people are traumatized, they are able to move, but the movement isn't flowing. There's not a movement in the flow or flowing in the movement. And what happens is when people get stuck in this freezing response, again, this is when the whole body freezes, or again, when the whole body just collapses from the inside. And again, we have to find ways to be able to help people move out of that, again, to have new experiences that give us a different way of seeing the whole world. You know, one of the things also that was really one of my discoveries, and Stephen Porges and I in the 1970s, we became very good friends, and we really collaborated with each other in many ways. And, you know, his understanding of the social engagement system, again, being able to co-regulate with somebody, and as well as to self-regulate within ourselves, we really need to have both, absolutely, really need to have both. Because if we are only able to co-regulate, then we can't, we're vulnerable when we're not with the person that's co-regulating us. At the same time, if we just use regulation to not be in relation to other people, that's also can be a problem. Although I have a feeling that more or less people that are by themselves are only able to do it by themselves are limited in how much they can regulate. You know, I can just, if you want, just maybe do a little exercise with your audience to give an idea of how we change these sensations from trauma to more flow.
Yeah, and please do.
So just a little bit of a background. There's a nerve that goes from the brain, actually from the back of the brain stem, and down throughout the whole body and wanders. And I actually call the vagus, which is like from vagabond, which is the wanderer from Latin. And it goes to all of our internal organs, especially to our guts, our gastrointestinal system, our viscera, goes to our lungs, to our heart. And when we see something, like I was just describing, we go out the door and we see somebody being hit by a car, or we think of something that happened to us a long time ago, our guts go, ugh. Again, that's something that's goes on in the body. I think most people can recognize that, at least, you know, times when that's happened in their lives. And that nerve, which is the largest nerve in the body by far, again, it goes from the brainstem to the viscera. But there's another part of that nerve that actually goes and takes information from the state of the viscera and brings it up to the brain, where it then can become amplified. So again, this nerve is 80% sensory afferent. In other words, the great majority of that nerve are actually taking information of the state of our guts and relaying that back up to the brain. So again, we see or something terrible happens to us or somebody we care about, and we go, ugh. So that's sending the nerve fibers. The vagus nerve is the largest nerve in the body by far. And so even 20% is a lot of nerves. So what it goes down to the guts, we go, ugh. Now that nerve is 80% afferent. In other words, it's taking information from the guts and relaying it to the brain. So you start with, ugh, then that goes from the brain to the guts. Then the guts send the signal back up to the brain and it amplifies that. So we have, And then after a period of time, we start, our digestion is off. We start having spasms in the guts. Sometimes it's called irritable bowel syndrome, you know, and that's when things get stuck. So how do you unstuck and help the person return to their self and to their flow, to their sense of self and being? And I found an exercise that's very, very helpful. And it helps regulate both the breath and this vagus nerve. So the idea here is to take an easy, full breath. And those of you who wish to do it with me, please be free. And if you have any, if it doesn't feel right to you, please don't do it. Also, it can bring up feelings. Most of the time, people feel a deep, deep sense of settling and relaxation, of regulation. But it could also bring up different sensations that might be a little bit strong at first, or might even bring up memories. But as I say, if you're able to just then follow whatever it is that's happening in the body, then move through it. And again, in the trauma therapies, so much is relegated to the mind, and the mind can just get stuck. But really, you have to unstuck what's underneath the mind, which again are our sensations, our feelings, and of course any images or meanings that we have as well. So the idea is to take an easy full breath. Well, let's just take a moment first just to get comfortable in our chairs and just feel how the chairs are supporting us, supporting our back, supporting our bottom, and feeling our feet touching the ground, and just noticing also our hands, and maybe just with curiosity, just kind of open them and close them a little bit, and just notice the way they open and the way they close. And just really not just watching, but really putting your mind into your hands. So you feel your hands physically opening and closing. Maybe even you might feel some kind of strength when your hands are closed. And when the hands open, maybe there's some sense of receptivity. But anyhow, just becoming aware of what's going on in the body. Okay. So in the exercise, we take an easy, full breath. And with the exhalation, we make the sound boo coming from the belly, vibrating it in the belly. So you're getting a new signal. You're sending a new signal from the belly back up to the brain. And just letting the breath and the sound go all the way out. And then just allow the next breath to come in, filling belly and chest. And again, once more. So those of you who wish, join. Also, if you don't, it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't feel safe enough at the moment, just watch me, listen to me, and just notice what effect that has, because we do affect each other profoundly, for better or for worse. Okay, so let me demonstrate. I'll do one cycle, and then we can do it together. And letting it vibrate there. I let the breath come in on its own. So, those of you who wish, let's just do it together, okay? So, easy full breath. Ooh, that, to just letting the sound and the breath all the way out. Ooh, let the breath come in. Just rest and just notice sensations, feelings, thoughts, images. You might notice some tingling or vibration, maybe coolness or warmth, cold or hot. And notice the sensations and notice if they seem to spread throughout the body. And when they spread, how does that feel to have that inner movement? Okay, so this is an exercise that you can practice. It can be done both alone or optimally to do it with somebody, to have a partner and to do the exercise first, for the one person to do the exercise and then the other person do the same exercise. And again, just to notice the difference in when you're doing that with a person.
One of the things that I noticed, Peter, I muted while I was doing it because the way that Zoom works, it focuses on the one that's speaking. But one of the things I noticed whilst I was doing it was that when often one's caught in their mind and the distractions, and there's something about it I found very grounding. I found myself becoming much more rooted and much more embodied in a sense. And I
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's a typical kind of experience that people report. But what's really interesting is this is something that involves two breaths with a sound, and it takes a minute or two. And again, some things like this frequently will happen that we'll really feel more settled in ourselves, term to use, grounded, more in the body, embodied. I mean, really, the task that trauma, the gift sort of that trauma can give to us, is it helps us to, because we need to heal. We need to find that embodiment, that connection to that deeper part of ourselves. And again, sometimes people just report they feel more relaxed. They feel some tingling or they feel some vibration. They have a thought about something. Maybe it's a thought about somebody that they know, somebody who's a friend of theirs. I mean, many different things can happen. But what the key is, and you touched on it, is that the thoughts are secondary to the bodily sensations. And when the bodily sensations can change, like doing something like this, when that can happen, then the thoughts by themselves shift. Our perceptions of the world, whether we perceive the world to be safe or to be dangerous, to be threatening or to be nourishing, that really comes from our internal experience.
It's really interesting, Peter, because one of the things that I think is often the trap that one gets into with trauma, but also particularly I think with anxiety as well, is that one feels unsafe. So one tries to think their way to a feeling of safety. It's like, if I can anticipate all the things are going to happen, or I can replay this event enough times in my head, then I can somehow think my way to that feeling. And what I'm hearing you say is that you can't think your way out of it, in a sense.
No, you can't. You can't. And often the thoughts just kind of feed on each other, you know. If you try to think of somehow to feel safety, how can I feel safety? I don't feel safety. So you start getting frustrated, and then you look for more thoughts, and the more thoughts maybe cause more frustration. And now, by the way, I'm absolutely not against working with people's thoughts. You know, we need to do that. And I call that top down. So it comes from the cortex down towards the body. And bottom up is coming from the body up to the brain, up to the psyche, to the mind. And we do need to unite them, the bottom up from the top down. But really, when we're stuck in the basement, in that bottom part, then we don't we really aren't able to tame those thoughts. I mean, to some degree, you know, we can, of course. And people who practice meditation learn, I think, to take some distance from the thoughts, to be able to observe the thoughts rather than being gripped in the thoughts. But again, to shift the whole system, when you shift it from inside the body, then the thoughts, they may need a little help, but the thoughts then turn to a more positive, more hopeful. Instead of dwelling only on the past, again, looking ahead for what might be happening in the future.
One of the other challenges that I think can happen is when one comes more into their body, one also often gets closer to those places that haven't been metabolized, that haven't been processed. And often one can feel unsafe as one gets toward, in a sense, the original trauma of not being held can start to arise. And that can often then lead to almost bouncing off that place back into the, what helps one cultivate that, in a sense, the inner holding that allows them to stay with what feels difficult?
Well, again, it has to do with the body sensations. There are two really important basic concepts in somatic experiencing. One is called titration, and the other is called pendulation. Pendulation is a made-up word. when we're working with a person in with SE, we only guide them to just touch into the traumatic sensations one small amount at a time, so that the person isn't overwhelmed. And a kind of a co-concept with that is pendulation. So when we first experience our bodies, and like you said, the unprocessed feelings and emotions and trauma, we feel a contraction. Our body contracts. So our shoulders, our neck, our jaws, our whole body just contracts. So when you touch into that initially, it doesn't feel good. But when you guide the person and titrate the experience, again, only one small piece of the experience at a time, when you do that, you can guide the person to feel into the contraction, because with every contraction, there's going to also be an expansion. And again, another contraction and a greater expansion. Another contraction and a greater expansion. So you're moving between the polarities of contraction and expansion. And the real trick is being able to hold them both without judgment. And if you are judging it, to not judge your judging. So it's really, again, you learn to trust in the body, that the body knows how to move through these unprocessed emotions. It has its own innate wisdom, something which we, I think, sometimes call embodiment. And, you know, we may have very, very clever minds. Many of us do. And however, our bodies are so much smarter and so much more clever if we learn to listen to the promptings of our bodies. And again, to just touch into these uncomfortable sensations enough to where they expand and contract and expand. And when we do that, we don't feel stuck, because we know, okay, so we're feeling tight, we're feeling a contraction. And then as I learn to follow that, I sense that little expansion. So being able to be guided, have someone guide us through this is at least initially, is very important. But again, what it becomes almost like an automatic skill, you could say, that we just, you know, whenever we feel upset, that we're able to touch into those sensations, you know. And couples, if we're in a couple, in a relationship, and one of the partners is feeling anxious, and then the other partner picks up some of that anxiety, and they feel anxious. And then that anxiousness escalates.
Becomes contagious.
That's often, right. That's often the time when they're then where there's a something like an anger bout. You know, you attack the other person, they attack you. You think they're attacking you, you attack them back because we feel unsafe. And when we feel unsafe, we want to protect ourselves. And again, biologically, we fight to protect ourselves, the flight or fight response. But if we can take a little time out and just be with each other and do exercises like what I just demonstrated with the VOO, then they can reconnect and say, you know, my gosh, I realized I was got really upset. And I think what I was upset about is, you know, that we had arranged to have to spend this time together, but you scheduled something else. Mm-hmm. So you're able to say what it is that you were angry about, say it clearly in a non-judgmental way, and in a way that can be healing to both. So the body really is the key to really how our lives will go.
Yes.
Whether we'll have, you know, productive lives, whether we'll have nourishing relationships. It's really, really essential to learn to hear and respond to the promptings, the inner promptings of the body. And this is called interoceptive awareness, become aware of our muscles, of our joints, and of our viscera, our guts, and to, again, listen to their messages, see what they're needing, see what they're wanting at the time.
I'd love to explore a little bit more the relationship one has with their body. You were mentioning about with titration and pendulation that, in a sense, the finding those edges and being gentle with those edges. And often when we've experienced trauma, often part of that is the perpetrators, let's say, of that trauma often have been overly harsh or have been insensitive towards us. And often that's how we've modeled that. We've learned that way of being with ourselves. So, you know, I remember in my own healing journey that when I first started working with my emotions, as someone who'd been conditioned and kind of learned to be very driven and pushy with myself, I used to get angry at my inability to feel my emotions and a fighting of it, which of course caused more of a shutdown. So it's almost like we try to solve the problem at the level we created it. And something often has to change, right, in that relationship.
Yeah, that's very well said, right? I think Einstein was the one who said, we can't solve problems in the same by the same system that created the problems in the first place. And you gave a good example. If somebody is really harsh to us, if our parents, caregivers are harsh, they're impatient, we will then interject that, we will swallow that, and we will then be harsh with ourselves. Also, if we're shamed chronically, then we again begin to shame ourselves. And shame is also, again, something that happens in the body. We fold in, we collapse around our diaphragm. Again, we lose our energy, our vitality just gets buried. And it's a really tough one to have happen in our adult life. You know, I consult for an addiction center called the Meadows, and they're in Arizona. And shame is such a central driving force in the addictive process, because you feel the shame and you'll do anything to not feel the shame. So you'll use a substance or act it out in some way. But that actually only increases the shame. I think somebody once said, shame is beneficial to an addict as salt water is to a thirsty to a person marooned, you know, on a raft. and but again, if we understand how shame is registered in our bodies, we can also move through the shame. So again, the shame, we tend to look away, avert our gaze. We don't want to look into the eyes of the person who's shaming us. We avert our eyes, we look down, and again, we collapse here around the diaphragm. Now it can be very subtle, I'm exaggerating it. But when people become aware of that in their bodies, and they can, again, like with pendulation, just slightly shift into that posture of shame, and then come back out again, just settle here, so that way you know you can go in, but you also then can come out. And again, to do this a few times, go in a little bit more, and then come out, allow the spine to lengthen, allow the shoulders to rest, to feel the breath. So, and those of you who are therapists, I think you realize that shame is probably one of the most difficult emotions to work with, clearly. And if you understand how it's registered in the body, then you can really help people move through that so they're not in the state of shame, and then they can look back at where that shame might have come from in the first place. But again, without that, if you're just trying to think about where the shame came from, what it was like to be shamed, again, it tends just to regurgitate the shame, and it doesn't really give us the movement through to resolving it somatically, physically, internally.
I'm finding myself thinking, you were saying a bit earlier, Peter, that we often need that co-regulation to support healing trauma, but there's also the self-regulation piece. And in a sense, in an ideal scenario, we have both of those. What do you, in terms of actual practices and tools, what do you find, the little exercise earlier is clearly part of this, and I can see how helpful that can be, but one that's learning to build that capacity for self-regulation, what might those, that kind of toolkit look like in terms of developing that?
Yeah, well, let's look at it developmentally. You know, when we're newborn, basically the newborn is unable to regulate anything. You know, they can't put on their shirt if they're cold, you know, and they need somebody to hold them and to soothe them. And again, this is the role of the parent or the caregiver. And that's so important because actually those rocking movements, they stimulate an area of the brain called the cerebellum. They do that through the vestibular system in the inner ear. And that actually down-regulates the rest of the brain, the cerebellum does. And again, it comes from those movements. One of the things that we've lost and in industrial society and technological industrial society is the hammock. And, you know, in so-called primitive cultures, you always, I mean, especially when, you know, when it's not freezing outside, you see hammocks and you see the parents, the caregivers with the infant in the hammock swinging together, regulating each other together. And that's the essence of co-regulation. And as a child grows and then becomes a toddler, they start to become more independent. They want to have their own lives. You know, the two-year-old wants to explore anything they can. And you have to keep an eye on them because they could do mortal harm to themselves because they'll just push or pull or jump. You know, so you have to be ready.
Fingers in the power sockets.
Yep, in the power sockets or in the sister's eyes or pulling the tail of the cat or the dog. You have to say stop, and that arrests the behavior. But then you also have to say, oh, sweetheart, you can't do that. We love you. You are completely lovable, but you can't do this. So in other words, and we stop the behavior with the shame, what I sometimes call the vagal break. It stops the shame, it stops that behavior in its track. And it also leaves you with that feeling, because if you want to do it again at another time, put your finger in the socket, you hear the words in your mind, no, No. But you also hear the words, I care about you, I love you, but this is dangerous. And so as we're able to then, okay, so that's co-regulation again. But then we start to be able to, okay, we've something happens and we get upset. We start learning the skills, even the toddler, that it can take a moment, when they have the fall, to sit down and maybe to cry. Again, that's a form of self-regulation. You're discharging that emotion. And then again, as the child grows up, they learn to play act, and they learn to tell stories, when they get to be about 5 years old. And they love their parents. That's when the child comes home with a picture of mommy or daddy and a big heart. And they say, we love you, And again, what they're doing is they're also giving some message of independence to themselves. And independence is also an important aspect. In Western society, especially in the United States, I think independence is overrated, the idea of competition, rather than sharing together work, cooperation. And cooperation requires some degree of co-regulation. But we also want to do our independent dance. And then we have to learn to regulate ourselves. If we don't do this, if we're unable to do this, then after a while, symptoms may start to occur. Anxiety may start to become a more common component of our experience. So, learning to regulate with another. Again, it's going to be okay, sweetheart. I'm dead. It's going to be okay. Sometimes when we're upset, assuming we had a good enough mothering, we'll call up our mother and say, this happened to me and I'm all upset. And then our mother says, sweetheart, it's okay. Just those words, it's okay. In other words, you're okay. Just helps us settle it up. So then can we take that experience of what it felt like when our mother or whoever it was said, it's okay, sweetheart, it's okay. How we take that, how we internalize that, and how we can then give that to ourselves through these kinds of exercises, like the two that I just demonstrated.
And what strikes me as well is that as you talk about those different stages of development, there are different kind of ingredients in a sense that one can recreate, right? Like that sensation of kind of the rocking and the movement to one's internal dialogue in terms of how one is talking to oneself, to that sense of how one is being with themselves, that there's a lot that we can learn from that.
Yeah, right. Not just talking, but talking and being with ourselves. There's another thing about this vagus nerve that's a little bit, not exactly mystical, but non-ordinary. And again, remember that 80% of that nerve is actually taking information from our guts, from our heart, from our lungs, and sending it up to the brain. And we all have identities. We have our ego identities. I'm a therapist, I'm a parent, I'm a teacher, I work in a store. Those are all identities, but they really have very little to do with who we are, to ourself, to our deep selves, to our true selves. And the true selves, and this is where the non-ordinary part comes from, the first sense of self really comes from our guts, comes from our viscera. you know, this is probably began when we were in utero, and that was our connection with the stream of life was through our guts, through the placenta. And you see the happy Buddha statues, and they all have these round, open bellies. So this is a really fundamental pre-egoic, non-egoic sense of self coming from our being able to register those bodily sensations of our viscera, to register them in our brains and be able to touch them and know that this is who we really are. So this is how we begin to develop not just self-regulation, but really connecting to the deeper part of ourselves.
And that is a unfolding and evolving relationship, right? Like I like what you said earlier around, these weren't quite the words that you used, but in a sense, one starts where they are. And it's if one can just manage a little piece of that, that's where one starts, as opposed to having this sort of idealization of this thing that, you know, people read, you know, like a book like The Power of Now, it just seems impossible to get to a place like that, as opposed to one cultivates from the place they start.
Yeah, but you use really good words, unfolding and evolving. And this process is a gradual process. It isn't unfolding. It's an emergence from these primitive self sensations, filling our whole organisms, filling our bodies. And this is a process that doesn't happen all at once. It happens over time. It's an evolution. And when you see people who are evolving in this direction, you know there's something special about them. There's some way that they're deeply connected to their selves that wouldn't it be nice if we could have some of that for ourselves? You know, and again, you meet somebody who really has that deep connection and you just know it right away, you know. Not just the Dalai Lama, but if you happen to meet the Dalai Lama on the street and you say hello to each other, he's transmitting something. You're receiving something. He's transmitting something. You're receiving something from him about what this connection is like. And again, taking it to relationships. If we don't have that sense of ourselves, we're always looking to the other to give us that identity, that sense of self. And that's a big burden to put on someone else. But if we feel our own selves, our own vitality, and then we choose to share that with somebody who also feels their own selfness, their own vitality, their own aliveness, then we can come together in a relationship. Otherwise, we're just playing against each other's childhood scenarios and our childhood traumas. And again, we find that we just keep getting into the stuck places, and then that leads to separation, leads to divorce. And then we find the next person to play out the same theater game with. So being able to self-regulate, and even more than just self-regulating, to be connected to the self. And then to choose to share that with another person who also has on that path themselves, who is unfolding. Again, nobody's going to be anywhere near perfect, not in this lifetime, but we can really get a good start. We can really get a good start and be able to celebrate within ourselves and celebrate with that chosen other.
Yes. And I'm mindful of time, Peter, but maybe just as a closing point, to just reiterate a little bit what you said earlier about there is enormous wisdom in our body. There is enormous wisdom in the process. And just say a little bit more about the surrender and the opening to that.
Yeah. In other words, to get this the wisdom from the body, we have to surrender to the bodily sensations. And sometimes surrender has a bad rap. Surrender means somehow that we're that we're giving up, you know, that it's not a positive thing. But really, if we look at what surrender means, for me at least, surrender means feeling our body sensations as they are, without confabulating them with a whole bunch of mishigash thoughts. It's really to feel our sensations as they are in their primary form, as they exist, as they live within our bodies. To me, that's what surrender is. And when we're able to do that, then that wisdom starts to emerge. You know, again, just doing a small exercise like the VU exercise, often people will report something like, I don't quite have the words for it, but somehow I feel more like myself. You know, and this wisdom goes beyond the words, gone beyond the words, the wisdom is. And that's where the wisdom is. It's in our bodies. It's in our connection, not just with our anatomical bodies, but our living, sensing, knowing bodies. That is the greatest gift that we can give to ourselves and give to each other. And it's what happens when we're able to transform traumatic experience that you could say would be a beneficial side effect. I'm just thinking of when I first got my clue about developing somatic experiencing, it was with a woman that, Nancy, I don't have time to say the story, but it's in Waking the Tiger, and I think also in Unspoken Voice. But anyhow, she was renegotiating. Also in SE, we don't have people relive traumas, but we have them touch the trauma and renegotiate the trauma. And she was doing that when she was, I think she was 4 years old, and she had a tonsillectomy, and they forced the ether mask on her face, which caused severe panic. And when she was working that through, she said to me, she said, it feels like I'm being held in warm, tingling waves. Feels like I'm being held in warm, tingling waves. Mm-hmm. That's wisdom.
Yeah.
And that comes from the body, from our ability to have a growing trust of our connection with our bodies.
Beautiful. That's beautiful, Peter. People that want to find out more about you and your work, they can go to somaticexperiencing.com. I know on there, there's some downloadable resources. You have public programs, free videos, and also your professional training. Anything you want to say about that?
Yes, the professional training is through the Somatic Experiencing International Institute. And their website is traumahealing.org, traumahealing, one word, .org. And they have trainings in, I think, 43 or 44 different countries, and practitioners in many, many countries. So if you wanted to work with somebody, you can get that information also from that website. And as I say, some of the public events that I do, like the one I'm doing with you right now, those are from the Somatic Experiencing, one word, .com website, and then there are the books that I've written, as I said, that look at this from very different angles. For people who are not therapists, Waking the Tiger is probably the best place to start, but the other books really deepen the exploration of embodiment, and also look at the whole question of memory. Again, people think of traumatic memories is that you remember the memory from here. It's not. You remember it from its effect on the body. So how do you work with that? Those memories are called procedural memories, or so-called body memories. So there's a lot of resource there. And even just practicing some of these simple exercises. Actually, I'll be recording in January, forgot about this, a program with Sounds True for for people who have a lot of these physical symptoms that are very frequently related to trauma. So chronic pain, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, we just mentioned, some kinds of migraines and so forth, to help people using these tools to heal from these symptoms.
Wonderful. That's one to look out for. Peter, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, gladly. I hope it's a benefit to your viewers.